Welcome to another one of our Big Biller interviews. This is Gary Staubel, as always, back with you with another interview. And this month, I'm excited to have John Magruder as our guest. I've never talked to someone who recruits recruiters that I can think of. Maybe I have, but I can't think of anyone. So it's something that I'm curious about. And I've got a lot of questions for John because that's his focus. That's his emphasis. His company is called R2R Search. He recruits headhunters for search firms, boutique firms, large firms, and he's based in New Jersey. And his company recruits, as I said, top talent in the recruiting area. I think all sorts of different niches. He's going to tell us a little more about the specifics. But I became aware of John actually from one of our interview guests who spoke very highly of his experience with him. So that prompted me to reach out to John. So John, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm looking forward to speaking to you.
Yeah, I appreciate it as well. I'm excited to be a part of this.
Well, maybe we could just start off. You could just tell us about your company, the types of people you recruit, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I heard you say you didn't never really talk to anybody that recruits recruiters. Don't feel bad. Most of the people that I talk to don't realize that's a thing either. So, but yeah, so after about 20 plus years in executive search, you know, I had a nice start with Robert Half and then was mostly focused on either working in my own boutique or working for other folks in the, you know, what I would call the small to medium sized privately held executive search firms. And then last December, you know, I decided to go ahead and step out on my own as I had built up some really nice relationships with some what I call tier one executive search firms. And was fortunate that they agreed to continue to work with me as I stepped out on my own. And that's what I've continued to do. So, you know, I usually tell people the best way to summarize it is that I work with firms that recruit for any and all functions. So it could be accounting and finance, could be IT or HR or sales and marketing or just about any niche you could ever possibly think of. And a good majority of the firms that I work with, especially since COVID, have embraced the work remote. So, but that does encompass staffing firms as well as fully retained search shops and contingency perms. So really anything in the agency space is, you know, a potential client of mine.
Has the, you mentioned virtual, I'm just curious about, I just literally finished a conversation with a coaching client. We talked about that change over the last year, 2 years, where companies are basically forced to consider having people that they hire that work out of state. Have you seen any change in that with search firms? Because I think a lot of firms would like to be digital if they could, but feel that there's more oversight. It's easier to manage, let's say, full cycle recruiters if you can hear what they're up to. I'm just curious if you've seen any change in that, you know, that openness to people out of state.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen a lot of change. And really, you know, it's not an easy question to answer about whether you should or you shouldn't. It's, I think it really boils down to how you want to build your team. A lot of the firms that they're hiring from me right now are hiring proven commodities, right? They're hiring proven producers with a track record. They're hiring people that should not need a lot of handholding, like you said, you know, monitoring what a recruiter's doing. You know, and if you're trying to grow your practice by hiring more entry-level folks and teaching them to do it your way from scratch, then I absolutely agree. I think it would be very difficult. Not impossible, but difficult to do it that way when it's 100% remote. But but like I said, a lot of the talent that I'm working with have, you know, minimum 5 years, and a lot of them have 10 and 15 and 20 years of experience. And so for them, you know, they've either already have been operating virtually for several years now or even quite a bit longer. And so really now it's just a matter of realigning with the right firm and continuing to do what they've always done successfully.
And so what type of searches would you fill? I mean, obviously, I think a normal full cycle recruiter would be someone you would do, but do you get into researchers or split desk situations, or what are the categories that you recruit for?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do it all. So if one of my clients needed a researcher, I'd absolutely help them do that. If they needed a full cycle recruiter, I'd help them do that. I'll tell you, I mean, a lot of the positions that I've been filling since I went out on my own here since last December have been more senior level, either individual contributors or player coach. There's been quite a few managing director, practice leader type placements in there where, you know, maybe they're coming in as an individual contributor day one, but we're quickly trying to scale a team around them. Here's an interesting trend that I thought you might find, you know, worthy of discussion. And that is that this year I have filled four roles that are very similar in that I've got executive search firms that are doing either fully retained or, you know, the hybrid container engagement model, high-end contingency, but they're perm shops. And they've wanted to expand by adding in a interim or contract and staffing division. So, you know, I've had multiple placements this year where they're hiring that leader, that person that comes in to really establish the foundation, the infrastructure, and then build out a team of salespeople and recruiters. But that's I've filled, I think, four of those positions this year already, and I've got three currently in the pipeline that I'm trying to fill right now. I think it boils down to a couple of things. You know, it's they do complement each other in a lot of situations. And and then also too, if you're thinking about an exit strategy at some point down the road as a firm owner, the value is much greater. I mean, and I'm talking 3, 4, 5x. So if you have a $5 million perm shop that you're selling and a $5 million contract shop that you're selling, you're going to get, you know, substantially more money on the sale of your firm if it's contract. So I think the blend complements the perm, and then it also builds value in the firm itself.
And that's funny that you mentioned that, because I just had a conversation this week with someone who was considering doing that. His company is successful. They have permanent placement is what they do. And he's looking at hiring someone who has a specialization in temp who could come in and start that for him. But you know, it's, if you've never done it before and you're hiring a person, it seems, you know, for me, it would be nice to know someone. Like if you were thinking of bringing someone in who was a partner or someone in a leadership role, it's scary to not know someone, the complete stranger, and then you're going to build an aspect of your business around just them. How do you work with a owner who's going to be, you know, I'm guessing fearful of making the wrong decision, paying a search fee, putting a lot of investment into this, and then having the person quit? Like, is there assessments or how do you go about evaluating a person for a role like that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've never actually had any of my hiring managers, founders, managing partners ever express any fear. You know, I mean, the way that I run my desk is I'm very thorough with my candidates. It doesn't preclude somebody from trying to misrepresent themselves, of course, but you know, there are a lot of things that we do to try and get to the heart of the matter and the truth. And a lot of that too is just knowing the industry as well as I do. I mean, there are certain shops where I'm pulling people out of that we know if somebody's been there for an extended period of time, they have to be who they say they are. You know, I mean, if you're pulling somebody out of a quality shop and they've got some experience and some tenure and they've, you know, been maybe promoted a couple of times and have shown a good trajectory, then, you know, you know what you're getting for the most part. I mean, that doesn't mean that they don't come in and fail. There's nobody, no guarantees on that for sure. But honestly, it doesn't happen very often. As I reflect, I've been recruiting recruiters for over 4 years now, almost four and a half. And as I think back to a lot of the placements, you know, that I've made, I mean, those people are still there. They're still doing the job that they were hired to do, or they've done it so well that they've gone on to get promoted and to do even more. So I don't have a lot of what I guess you would call fallout or fall offs. I don't have a lot of that. And I think, again, not focusing on the entry-level roles helps because, you know, when I'm pulling somebody that's got 6 to 10 to 15 years in one or two shops and there's a proven track record and then you place them at another firm, traditionally it works. I mean, that's just been my experience anyway.
Okay. And with someone who has been successful for another firm, you know, there's the entrepreneurial question where oftentimes if someone is successful as a recruiter, let's say they're billing 300K plus and they've been doing it for a few years, they're at some point going to ask themselves, you know, why shouldn't I go out and do this on my own? Right. So if you're recruiting someone at that level, is that a question that you go through with them, or where, you know what I mean? Like if you're someone who's billing 400 or 500K, then you could do it on your own if you wanted to. So I'm just wondering, when you're evaluating people, how do you kind of screen for someone who's a closeted entrepreneur, let's say?
Well, you know, that does come up from time to time where people say, hey, I'm really considering going out on my own. And I'm able to offer some good advice. I've done it multiple times myself. So I think people often underestimate the operational infrastructure build, not just from a financial standpoint, but just from a time standpoint, how much time it actually takes to run a business versus actually, doing the job inside of your business. I mean, every time that you're on the phone with your bookkeeper, every time that you're shopping for benefits for your employees or doing a website rebuild or figuring out, you know, how to add more LinkedIn recruiter seats or changing your ATS or any of those things that all have to happen behind the scenes, you're not on the phone with clients and candidates. So that 300K biller is probably not going to be a 300K biller on their own. Now, does that mean that they could be a 200K biller? And if you're keeping the majority of it, is that a raise from where you're at? Potentially, you know, but not everybody, and I would even say most people, are not going to find it as rewarding or even be as successful at running the business as they are running a desk. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you, here's a real world example. I think I told you prior, I like to tell stories. So here's a story to kind of give you an idea of what I'm talking about here. So we just had an offer accepted today. This woman, I won't obviously use any names because notice hasn't been given, but this woman has a 20-year track record in executive search. And and so this year, year to date, she had billed 1.2 million in her niche. And, she saw the value in joining an established boutique for multiple reasons. Mm-hmm. One, all of that infrastructure and operational support is in place. Not only do they have, all the sophisticated tools from LinkedIn Recruiter and Zoom Info, but they have an outside marketing firm that they use that uses data analytics and SEO optimization so that they can drive leads in for that person. They also have significant financial resources so they can scale a team around her much more aggressively than she could on her own. They also have multiple verticals that are represented, and she had often complained that at her current firm, which is a very narrow niche search firm, that when she would bring in or get a request to take on a retainer for a different functional role, her firm would just say no, like you can't do it. And we're talking about this year alone, she turned away three CFO retained searches that in total probably was somewhere close to $400,000 to $500,000 in fees. And she had to send that to some other company because she didn't have a counterpart, that she could hand that business to. So, in her mind, not only can she probably contribute at a much more efficient and higher rate on her own desk with all of the resources and tools that this firm is giving her, but she can also have partners by which to capitalize on additional searches that she's getting from all of her well-established relationships she has in the marketplace. So in our eyes and in hers, that $1.2 million biller is really more like a $2 million biller. And then once we start putting a strong team around her, then it'll become much, much more over time.
So I'm curious, what size search firm is your typical client? You know, if it's a really small boutique or like a mid-sized firm, what size would you say is normal for you?
Yeah, I'm definitely more in the SMB stage. I have a few firms that I've built relationships with that are, national, that have, multiple locations and things like that. But really where I spend 90 plus percent of my time is in you know, like one location, or, you know, I say one location, if they even have a location anymore. A lot of the firms I'm working mm-hmm. with have given up brick and mortar altogether, but they, you know, host work remote anywhere in the country. And I always like to tell people when they're considering using me for, you know, some hiring needs that they have, and I'm talking to them about embracing virtual, I'm like, you know, it's the difference between fishing in a pond and fishing in the ocean. You know, I mean, if mm-hmm. you want truly the best billers in the industry, let me go at where they are, which mm-hmm. that could be Little Rock, Arkansas. It could be Omaha, Nebraska. It could be in Indianapolis. So, you know, I've pulled $1 million billers out of all of those kinds of locations, because, you know, location isn't the main factor anymore in trying mm-hmm. to identify the talent that's best, you know, for the firm. So, but I definitely like the nimbleness of the small to medium sized shops. Most of the firms I work with, we can get very creative. I often tell candidates, I'm not going to try and fit you in a box. Okay. I'm going to try and take you someplace that wants to build the right box around you. So, you know, whether that's customizing the commission schedule, you know, whether that's working out a commission plan that is still going to be aggressive, but allow you to be on a guaranteed base and not a draw, you know, mm-hmm. but having the flexibility to go either direction, depending upon the candidate that you're talking to. So mm-hmm. there's, you know, a lot of the firms that I work with tend to have a tremendous amount of flexibility, which during this current market that we're in right now, which is unlike anything I've ever seen, mm-hmm. as far as how hard it is to get a recruiter to move from one agency to another. Mm-hmm. You know, the hard part about doing that is that you're leaving a hot desk and going to a cold desk. There's just no avoiding
yeah.
it. You have to start over. And when people are experiencing all-time highs, you know, year-to-date, quarter-to-date, you know, month-to-date, where they're billing more than they've ever billed, they've got a substantial amount of receivables, their pipeline's never been stronger, it's hard, mm-hmm. even if they don't like their manager, even if they're being forced to go in the office, even if they have a lot of pain, it's mm-hmm. the old golden handcuffs are clamping down on a lot of people right now. So either somebody has to be in acute pain, or I have to work with companies that are willing to understand that they've got to get creative in times like these to bring good talent over. And that's really what it is. I'm getting a lot of people first year guarantees. And a lot of the firms that are hiring them know that they may not recoup that in the first year. It may be, mm-hmm. it may be a bit of a loss, or maybe even at best a break even in year mm-hmm. one. But, you know, we're also going after top talent. So in year two, they should shine bright and we should be off to the races. And hopefully we're talking about a 5, 10, 15 year relationship that will make looking at the first year, you know, not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. So and that came up as well with another conversation this week. It's kind of funny you're touching on a lot of stuff that's recently kind of percolated in my mind. One of them, this idea of a first year guarantee, if you're trying to move someone who's, like you said, if they're already, you know, billing 500K or 400K, whatever it is, to leave there and go to a new position where they're starting from ground zero, what kind of, can you talk about that first year guarantee? I'm just curious what that looks like or what that could look like.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I can give you multiple examples because almost every placement I've made since May has been in that fashion or form of some kind. So, some of the ways that we're going to try and accomplish that, like I told you about the woman that just accepted the job today. So for her, you know, we were able to negotiate a very strong draw. So, you know, like a significant six-figure draw, let's just say that. And, mm-hmm. And then on top of that, we did, so she has some unpaid commissions that she's walking away from if she leaves. And so mm-hmm. we took, that dollar amount that she's walking away from and put it on the, offer as a sign-on bonus. Mm-hmm. So, and then we also put an additional, advance, if you will, almost like a draw on top of a draw. To get her biweekly checkup to a point where she can be comfortable. But, you know, at the end of the day, if she does anything close to what she did this year, next year, then mm-hmm. it'll all be a wash anyway. I mean, a draw is an advance on your commissions. So even though we gave her an extra healthy one this year, we're not really concerned about being able to recapture that she'll actually blow that away fairly easily. And then she'll, have definitely paid for herself in the first mm-hmm. year and beyond. So, that's like one example of an offer that we got that we had to do to get her. We weren't going to mm-hmm. get her if we didn't do all of those things. And so I just picked up a new job order today, this week, with a company. They're a $10 million boutique. They're 5 million perm, 5 million contract. They want to become mm-hmm. a $20 to $25 million firm, in the near future. And they feel like the best way to do that is to launch another staffing division in a different vertical or industry focus. And mm-hmm. so, when I was talking to them about the state of the market and what some of the things I thought they had to do, when I asked them, what can I talk to passive talent about as far as, guarantees, and they're prepared, and again, unique to their circumstances, I'm sure, to offer somebody a guarantee between $200,000 and $300,000 their first year. It's a big job, and he even said, I realize I probably will not, make any profit on that in the first year, and I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. So what it's made up of is there'll be a salary that after the first 12 months are up, you'll revert back to, right? Like, so let's just say it's a $100,000 salary. And then, on top of that, they're going to put, some a non-recoverable draw is probably the best way to say it, of, $150,000 to $200,000 on top of that for the first 12 months. So mm-hmm. then, I can take somebody off of a hot desk that's making that kind of money, and I can put them over there. And, he's also offering a path to partnership. So there's equity in that division or that P&L. That won't be given up front. That's something that's mm-hmm. earned by hitting certain targets and thresholds. Mm-hmm. But it's a really, that's the kind of opportunity I have to have in order to mm-hmm. go tap people on the shoulder and get them to take a phone call these days. It's just, you can't, as I think about the jobs, I'm struggling to help good customers that have hired a lot of people from me over the years. It's mm-hmm. the run of the mill, full desk, individual contributor with a $60,000 to $70,000 or $80,000 draw, good, decent commissions, 40, 50, 55% tiers. That's the job that I almost cannot fill today. It's just mm-hmm. because that job is probably the job that they're already in. And mm-hmm. then if they've been experiencing the kind of success that a lot of the people in the industry have had this year so far, there's just not enough incentive to walk away from an established hot desk and go over and reestablish somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's, so those are the things that I'm trying to educate, the hiring managers yeah. on, that you can hire good people, but you have to do more today to get them than you did this time last year.
Yeah. It's funny hearing you talk about the things that you have to educate recruiting firm owners on, because I spend all day talking to people about educating their clients, and never, we don't really think of ourselves as clients in that sense. You know what I mean? Where somebody would say, hey, you need to be realistic about these aspects of what you're offering. But it makes sense to me that you would have to get creative. That last example you gave was $100,000 salary plus a non-recoverable draw for the first 12 months. So in that case, does the $100,000 salary would continue in year two, but the non-recoverable draw does not continue in year two? Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. All right. And in that case, I know it may not translate, but how much is that draw, or what might a draw be if someone already has a $100,000 salary?
Well, in that particular case, it would be an additional $100,000 to $200,000. So think about it this way, right? So if I'm at a company and I've traditionally W-2'd around $300,000 the last 3 or 4 years, my salary may only be $80,000. But mm-hmm. In this case, I'm thinking interim and contract. So but if I'm running at $25,000 or $30,000 a week in gross profit, then I'm being paid commissions on that on top of my $80,000 salary. So mm-hmm. my biweekly check looks like somebody who's making $300,000 a year. So mm-hmm. what the firm that would hire them would do is give them, give them a $100,000 salary. So their salary is actually going up 20%. If they were at 80, we're giving them 100. Mm-hmm. Then on top of that, for the first 12 months, we're going to put a non-recoverable draw that hopefully you outperform, and then I'm paying you even more. But realistically, you're probably not going to generate enough profit based on a traditional commission schedule to offset that big of a non-recoverable draw. But we're doing it to ease that transition from a hot desk to a brand new one. So then when the 12 months expire, the non-recoverable draw falls off. It just goes away. And then you're back to your $100,000 salary and then just whatever commissions you're getting based on your gross profit that you're bringing in each week.
Okay. Got it. That's interesting. Do you get much resistance to this from owners who look at this? Because I can hear some people saying, wait, I'm guaranteeing a 100K salary plus a 100K draw. That's a 200K commitment to someone who might quit after a year, let's say.
Well, but you also have to keep in mind what you're acquiring. So I'm not bringing you a $300,000, biller for that. I'm bringing you the $1.2 million biller for, the woman that I just told you accepted today to go to a new firm through me. So, you have to look at what the investment is and, and that's why, a lot of my phone rings frequently with firms that want me to come in and help them hire. And unfortunately, as a man on an island right now, I am looking to, build out my team as well, but I can only do so much. Right. And so, and I know how difficult it has been this year, especially in Q2 and Q3 to just find good, strong billers to move from one place to another. So I've almost, I don't want to say I've abandoned that search. I haven't abandoned that search, but I focus on the searches like we just talked about where there's some, first year guarantees. We're talking about scaling a team, a path to partnership and equity, because I can take that to a market that's this crazy and generate interest, and I can get interviews and I can get people to move and take that job. So, you just have to think about what you're acquiring. It does sound like a big financial commitment. And yes, I definitely get pushback from a lot of firms that are nowhere of the mindset that that's anything they would be interested in doing. But those are the firms that are, knocking on my door the loudest because they can't hire good people. And I have to tell them, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Like I'm trying, but it's just that part of the market that they're going after is the same part of the market that everybody else is going after. And so, and given that people are experiencing tremendous success, you can't offer them the same thing. You have to do something more. So I will say, like most of the placements that I'm making, we're talking about top talent. I would say the majority of the people I've placed this year on the perm side are north of $500,000 in annual billings. And the majority of the folks on the contract side of the house that I'm placing are north of $750,000 to $1 million in gross profit annually. So,
$750,000 to $1 million in gross profit, you said.
I'm just trying to use annual numbers because I'm comparing it to perm. So, so those are a lot of the candidates that I'm targeting. Those are a lot of the candidates I'm going after. And so when you're bringing on somebody I'm thinking about people that are actually in my pipeline right now and the ones that I've recently placed, I mean, they have very stable job history. There's not a lot of jumping around. They've been in their seat for a number of years. They're coming out of firms that people know and respect. They have very, sophisticated training programs. They usually, in a lot of cases, especially if they're in a bigger firm, have pretty rigorous metrics and KPIs that these people have been accountable to for years. And so, they've formed excellent habits. And if I put them in a smaller environment where they have a lot more autonomy and freedom, they tend to continue to do what they're habitually have been trained to do for the last decade. And so you don't have to ride their coattails. You don't have to see what their call time is, how many calls they made, how many resumes they sent out. They're going to take care of business. You just watch the scoreboard. That's what you watch, right? Because it's like, okay, you had how many starts this week? What's your gross margin? You placed how many people this month? What were the fees? Because the people that we're trying to bring to these boutiques are proven commodities, and they really don't need a lot of handholding.
Okay. And I'm glad you said that, because somebody who's 500K plus, would obviously have a very different, you'd have to attract them in a very different way than someone who's at 250,
Yeah, I would find it very difficult to believe that there are any of my competitors are having very much success placing, you know, candidates that are, like, say, in this case, perm full desk, billing between $250 and $350. That's a segment of the market that I can't even imagine trying to focus on right now. Mm-hmm. I would lose what little hair I have left.
All right. Well, let's talk about just the state of the industry. Do you have any sense of where, not that you're Nostradamus, but just your own sense of where the industry is going over the next 5 years? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. I mean, look, I talk to firm owners. I've got some connection points out there that are very well respected in our industry that I've asked that question. You know, we mm-hmm. constantly are trying to play Nostradamus. And I think the common belief right now is that we are in the hottest market for search and staffing that ever in the United States, ever. I've been in this game since the mid 90s, so I can't really speak to anything prior to that, but certainly since the mid 90s to present, there's never been anything like this as far as the demand and the need for search. And so our best guess is this is a wave we're going to get to ride for at least the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. I think this takes us through 2023 and could very well be beyond that. I mean, there's a lot of variables in there that could dictate something other than that, of course. But our best guess is that we don't see any bumps in the road right now. And that's across most industry, vertical, functional areas of specialty. So, mm-hmm. I mean, accounting and finance and IT are always hot. Life sciences is exceptionally hot right now. I've got so many life science companies that are begging me for help to bring people in. Mm-hmm. But really, it's just everything. I mean, human resources, the human resources practice area right now is as hot as it's ever been because of mm-hmm. COVID. COVID has changed mm-hmm. the way the workforce operates. Now you're yep. managing remotely. You've got diversity and inclusion has become such an important factor in the search industry, and that creates extra layers of human resources that are needed in these organizations. And so I know a lot of people that are in the HR search practice area are experiencing phenomenal growth and demand. You know, you often call this market, it's a candidate driven market, right? Mm-hmm. you just got to go find good talent. And I often say that if I had a $500,000 full desk, anything, I don't care what their specialty is, I could knock on 10 doors and I'd probably get 8 or 9 that would answer. And I'd get at least half of those that would agree to my terms. And I'm not bashful to tell you, I'm probably the most expensive in our industry, but I deliver. And I definitely feel like my clients feel the value is there, but I really mm-hmm. do. I try to work with the best and I try to find the best. And so I'm going to charge more than maybe somebody who's not focusing in that area. Mm-hmm. But the market conditions are insane right now. It's I really felt it. It was palatable like mid-May. Here's the great example. So, I was averaging close to a placement a week from the beginning of the year through May. And then I had 7 or 8 offers turned down in a row. That's not a PR I prefer to set. But 7 of the 8 stayed put. And I got, I went up against a really big firm that had much deeper pockets than my boutique did. And they purchased the talent away from us. We couldn't keep up with what they were willing to offer. And those 7 all said the same thing. It's like, this is clearly a better opportunity, but it's bad mm-hmm. timing. I just can't mm-hmm. leave where I'm at. And almost all of those were individual contributors. So that's where my opinions are coming from. Mm-hmm. I shifted away from individual contributors after I had 7 declined offers because they're going to stay put and realize that's probably not going to be the best place for me to hang out for the next few months. And that's when I shifted to more of the senior level roles like we're discussing before.
Meaning someone who's going to go and build a team for another company? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Like somebody's going to launch a new division. We're going to scale a team around them. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that I pick up a job where they walk in leading a team. It's very, very rare. I think you even intimated earlier in our conversation about something along the lines of most of the time firms are going to try and, make their leaders come up organically. So they have the respect, right? Mm-hmm. They've earned their stripes, if you will. And I do believe that that's still very much the mantra that I hear. Now, it's, you know, it happens. There are times when I get asked to bring in a leader day one, but the vast majority of the time I'm bringing somebody that's either has led or is very capable of leading, and then asking them to, at least for a few months, operate as an individual contributor, and then let's scale a team around them. And then the fun part for me is I oftentimes, and I get to play a part of that. And that's where I really enjoy, you know, I place the leader and then I place the team around the leader and watch them flourish and, you know, become a multi-million dollar unit at these organizations. And that for me is just the biggest kick in the pants I could ask for. I love that. So, you know, that's making a difference.
Yeah.
I've got a firm that I began a relationship with about 3 years ago, and I think they were right around 1.5 to 1.8 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. This year they're on track for 7 million. And with the hires that they're making in the second half of the year through me, we're projecting no less than 10 and maybe as much as 12 million in revenue next year. And I placed every single practice leader in that organization in the last 3 years.
Mm. Now you placed in the last 3 years. Did you start this? Was this a separate business? Because I thought you said you started last December. So I don't know if.
So I was with another firm. I wasn't in an ownership stake. They were a 6 month old startup at the time that I joined them, and that's when I got introduced to the niche of recruitment professionals for recruiting firms. We spent almost 4 years together before I decided to part ways. What happened was I built a niche within a niche. You know, they were much more diverse in the types of clients that they wanted to work with. And I just sort of really isolated in on the boutique search firm. And for me, that's just where I have the most fun. I can relate to them. And honestly, because of the amount of experience that I've had, I've built teams, I've hired and trained a lot of recruiters in my day. And at the end of the, you know, I feel like I'm much more of an advisor than I am a vendor of talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So in terms of finding talent, because I know there's a major shortage for almost everyone right now, when you think of a successful recruiter, besides their production, because I'm guessing you have some criteria of minimal production, what are the common denominators in successful recruiters that you look for?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think there are definitely some common traits that I see in people that do really well. You know, I think most of us are financially motivated. That would be one, right? What other job can you think of that you can do in somewhere between usually 40 and 60 hours a week? I know there are others out there that work much more than that, but let's just say most of us work 40 to 60 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Most of us don't have to travel. Most of us don't have to work weekends and make more than most of the doctors and lawyers in our town. You know, I mean, it's an incredible job. And if you do it right, it can be exceptionally financially rewarding. And the beautiful part about it is, it's like, you know, I know people that are, you know, millionaires from doing this job and they only had a high school degree. You know, they're just very driven and hardworking. And it's not that I don't recommend people don't go to college. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that there's no entry barriers of any type. You know, the common denominator is you have a gift for the gab, right? Can you talk to people, build relationships successfully, earn their trust, and just do a good job? You know, just take care of your clients, take care of your candidates, and do a good job. So I would say for me, the traits, I mean, the people's backgrounds that I see the most are former athletes. Former athletes tend to do really well on recruitment because they're used to the grind. You know, they're used to somebody kind of yelling at them. I'm not saying that you get yelled at in this industry, but you know what I mean? They're used to dealing with adversity, and then they still wake up each morning with a smile on their face saying, I'm going to do better. I'm going to try harder. And you kind of have to have that grit and grind in this industry, I think, to be successful. So, you know, I'm old school. I would add in that you also can't be afraid of the phone. I know there are a lot of people out there in this modern age that do a lot of business via text and email. But I'm a big believer of getting on the phone and talking to people and establishing those relationships. But I think other than that, you know, it just really varies depending upon, you know, the nuances of maybe your niche or industry. I mean, you know, there's a lot of firms out there that promote, you know, hosting events, bringing in experts, you know, panelists, doing webinars, TED Talks or whatever. You know, a lot of the firms that I work with fly under the radar because they're not doing those things and they're having a ton of success. So there's really, you know, more than one way to get there for sure. That's the other thing too, that I love about what I do is, oops, I'm sorry, is that I see how many different ways there are to be successful in this industry. And that involves the type of talent that you bring on. I mean, I know firms that have never hired anybody externally with industry experience that are tremendously successful. They've only ever hired people that have never done the job and then taught them to do it their way. And then I've had other firms that would never dream of doing that. And they would only hire proven experts, but both are successful. So, you know, I think, you know, when I'm talking to people, there's a confidence, there's a, I think you have to have some street smarts. What do they call it? EQ, like emotional intelligence. If you can kind of hear what they mean, not what they say sort of thing. And I think those things go a very long way to being a successful recruiter.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the differences in types of firms. One might only grow their own big billers from scratch. The other might only hire people who've already succeeded. Those are, you know, I talk about those as one being systems first, which is the one who grows their own. We're going to focus on our systems. We're going to focus on our methodology that we can train someone who might be average in their skill, but we can get them to be exceptional because our system is exceptional. Whereas the other one is more of a good to great model, meaning I find somebody who's already succeed and I'm bringing in a superstar, and I bring in that superstar because they can hit the ground running. And I think it is true. You can do either, you know, and there's probably a lot of variation between, but companies do succeed doing both of those. I guess another question would be, why would an owner work with you versus filling the search on their own? I can guess, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because I'm sure that some people say, well, that sounds great, but I'm going to do this on my own. What would you say in that case when you're talking to someone?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is my, you know, full-time job. My full-time job is to build relationships, network. I understand the industry very well, but I do it all day, every day. And that's why I'm as good at it as I am. A firm owner that specializes in pick your poison, technology placements, right? They know the IT space exceptionally well. They know where, you know, which companies have the best software engineers. They know, you know, which educational pedigrees do the best in their industry. You know, they understand that. And that's what they spend their day doing all day is networking, building those relationships. So they are the expert. So if I'm running an IT shop and my main focus is to find top IT talent for my companies, exactly how much time and how good can I be at finding the best recruiters in the market? So there are some out there that actually do a very good job. I'll be honest. They carve out a part of their day to stay close to their competitors and the top earners and producers at their competitors. And they put them on some sort of a drip campaign and try to, you know, stay in the moment with those people so that when they are ready to leave, they can have a conversation. But yeah, it's very, very difficult. And I got to be honest, it's so rare when I have any pushback whatsoever. So I think a lot of the firm owners see how important it is. And they've experienced the frustration, you know, when they do want to hire and all of a sudden they drop everything that they're doing. They send out a bunch of LinkedIn emails. They pick up the phone and call people, whatever it is that they're doing. And they run into that brick wall. Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's their first run at it. It's they're trying to almost basically launch a desk in a new vertical, even though it is for an internal hire. So, you know, I can't remember the last time I ever had anybody say to me, you know, I can just do this on my own. They already know that they can't, at least not at the level that I'm trying to deliver for them on, which is, again, very, very top talent in our industry. You know, that's the other thing too, is like, I talk to people all day long that are in our industry and I talk to hiring managers. I have a very unique perspective, right? I often tell people I've probably recruited for roughly 100 different, mostly boutique search firms across the country over my last 4.5 years. And I've recruited out of hundreds of others, if not maybe a thousand. I mean, I pulled from everywhere that you could think of. And so, you know, I know how everybody's comp plans work. I know common complaints when people are leaving. I know a lot about culture. I know a lot about, you know, the direction the company's trying to go. I understand the bar. I understand if they worked at that company for this long, they're probably trained really well in doing this or that. It's just, you know, that's a lot of knowledge that took a long time to accumulate. And that's what they're willing to pay me a fee for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it makes sense. If you talk to a candidate and they say, I build 500K over the last year, or I'm on track to build 500K this year, do you just take their word for that? Do you verify it in some way? How would somebody know what the person actually built?
Well, it's changed over the years because there's laws now that prevent me from requesting, you know, documentation that, you know, would be something that you could say is verifiable, that they are at the level that they're at. And I don't really want to, that's kind of a secret sauce thing that I have. And so I'm not going to give you too many details on this,
okay.
But I think the best way I could probably summarize it is I'm really good through, multiple lines of questioning at identifying when I'm being told the truth and not. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. One of the tougher things about recruiting recruiters is we know what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. We know exactly what tail to spin, but unfortunately, or fortunately for me, there's not a lot of depth into that thought process. So if they try to get on the phone with me and say that they're operating at a certain level, I know how to ask other questions to figure out if I'm being told the truth or not. And fortunately, it feels like, you know, based on the success that the people that I'm placing are having with their new firms, that we're good. We've been doing a good job of that.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of hiring or training, you know, the attrition rate in our business is traditionally pretty horrible, right? It used to be around 80%. I don't know what it is today, meaning if you hire 10 people, two of them are left at the end of 10 years, or excuse me, at the end of 1 year. Not proven producers, but just your garden variety 10 hires. So first off, do you have any comment on why that is? Why do you think the attrition rate is so terrible?
Well, I talked to the point that the entry barrier is very, very small. Like there's just very few reasons that on paper you would not give somebody a chance to do this job. And unfortunately, I don't believe this is the right way to do it, but there's a hiring philosophy, especially in certain larger shops, that you hire 10 warm bodies and you pray two of them last 6 months. And that's the expectation, is to bring in a class of 10 each month or each biweekly period, you know, run them through a training program, put them on the phone, monitor their performance, get rid of the ones that can't figure it out, keep the ones that can. And that could be 1 to 2 to 3 people at best out of 10. So that's probably driving that metric a little bit. But, and I think that's also part of the reason why I like recruiting for the particular segment of the market that I focus on, is that the people that I'm working with have had enough exposure to the industry to know that this is where they want to hang their hat forever. And so, you know, it's not, but when you're hiring people that, look, everybody has to get a shot at some point. Everybody has to have their first job. And when you get into the seat, it can feel very uncomfortable. I'll admit, when I was at Robert Half in my first year, I was very uncomfortable. I also, you know, am stubborn, and I didn't want to give up, and I just kept fighting through the pain. And then pretty soon it wasn't as much as painful. And then it got easier and it got easier and it got easier. But I think there are a lot of people out there that at that first glimpse of the grind, you know, they quickly pivot and go a different direction. And and I'll tell you, like with what's going on in the market right now, a very average recruiter with mediocre skills and work ethic can come in and make good money. I mean, you know, you can make $100,000 and not be very good at this job, which is crazy to say, but it's the truth. But at some point, our market will level out again, like it did during the global financial crisis or the dot-com bubble, you know, busting, or any of that stuff that happened that really rocked our industry for, months and years, the strong will survive and the meek will get weeded out. And mm-hmm. that cycle is probably going to continue forever.
So I
don't know if that answers your question, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, I think it's also, there's a big difference between newbies who've never done it before versus someone who's a senior person who knows exactly what they're getting into. And unfortunately, I don't know any stats. It would be nice to know what is the attrition rate for brand new people versus those who've been doing it, say, 3 years, you know? And my guess is they would be quite different.
I mean, just to build on that, you know, one of the common paths I see people take that have been in the industry for a few years, but then decide that it's not for them, is that internal in-house talent acquisition role. That's a very, very common path. And it's mm-hmm. a very common thing that I have told to me when I'm reaching out to people, especially those that are, you know, say 5 years or less experience. I would bet that if I had nothing but calls with people with 5 or less years of experience, at least half would tell me, I'm not going to leave for another agency, but if you find something in-house, I'm good to go. Let me know. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, and there is a huge demand for that segment of the market right now. So a lot of those people are making that shift to the in-house. But, you know, I will admit that my opinion is jaded because nobody ever calls me that takes that path just to tell me how awesome it was. Like, they call me because it wasn't what they thought it was. And, you know, that's why they're calling me. They're like, hey, I did agency for 3 years. I went in-house and I realized quickly that's not for me. Can you help me get back into agency? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the complaints that I hear from people exiting agency and going into industry are, well, first of all, you're moving from one side of the spreadsheet to the other. You know, if you're in an agency and you're generating revenue, you're an asset. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if you're the world's best recruiter. When you go to a company in-house, you're a liability because you're no longer mm-hmm. generating revenue. And the moment that they have a hiring freeze for any reason at all, lost their biggest client, big lawsuit, downturn in the economy, doesn't matter. You're the first layer of fat to be trimmed off the hog. Right. Mm-hmm. It just, you're not providing value no matter how good you are if I'm not hiring anybody. So, you know, and then the other part that I hear, it's kind of a funny thing, but, you know, we take it for granted on the agency side, you get to pick who you work with. Like, it's your choice. Mm-hmm. If you bring on a new client and it is not a pleasant experience, then you just don't work with them anymore. It's the freedom of choice. When you go in-house and you're working with a terrible manager with a champagne taste and a beer budget, and you got to look and talk to them every day about your pipeline, if you don't have a choice, that's your job. Your job is to work with that hiring manager and help them. So, you know, like I said, I always say, take it with a grain of salt. I only hear the negative. Don't hear the mm-hmm. positive. But there's mm-hmm. additional things that I don't want to take up all of our time with. It would lend itself to that as well. But I see that path a lot because people get worn down by the grind of, you know, the fast-paced nature of what we do, hearing no a lot. You know, those are the common things that people tend to shy away from. If it doesn't feel good, I'll go somewhere else where I don't have to experience that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're getting close to, I'm going to recap some thoughts here in just a few minutes, but I'm just curious your thoughts on when someone comes over, let's say somebody is a 500K biller and I'm an owner and I've got 3 recruiters working for me and we have a metrics-centric orientation, meaning they're reporting their numbers to me. And that's just a part of the culture that we have with my 3 recruiters. If I bring over someone at 500K, do you find that there's any pushback? Maybe they weren't having to be, maybe they consider it micromanaging because now they have to turn in stats that they didn't used to have to turn in. Does that come up at all as far as, I'm guessing someone who's at a higher level does not want to feel micromanaged. And so it might be a little bit of a process of being able to set it up in a way where they are reporting, but it's not heavy handed. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I will admit that a lot of the people that I'm pulling out of the larger shops and placing them in the smaller shops, that's a big sizzle point that I can put in front of them. It's like, you know, you're not going to, you know, fill out reports. You're not going to, you know, keep a call log. You're not going mm-hmm. to track certain things that you're probably used to tracking right now, because quite honestly, they don't care. It's like, you know, what can we do to help you make placements? And some people are much more efficient at it than others. I know that was always my case. I would make half as many calls as most of the people around me, but I would still either bill the same amount or more because I was just much more efficient at choosing mm-hmm. which calls to be on and then, you know, doing the right things on that call. So, yes, that is absolutely a point. And I always tell you that the firms that I work with, so now I'm switching to the new place of employment. I mean, most of them have something they track, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. it could be, you know, number of candidates brought in a week, could be number of interviews scheduled. But it's not a heavy handed, it's just more like, you know, informative, you know, mm-hmm. they'll set quarterly goals. You know, if they're hitting their goals, I always tell people with success comes freedom. So mm-hmm. if you come in and you produce, you can earn the right to ask for more freedom or less reporting or whatever to a degree. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just alienate yourself from the rest of the team. If everybody else on the team has to talk about their activity for the week, then you know, you should step up and talk about your activity of the week. But nobody's going to reflect on it in a way where they try to tell you what to do. It's like, mm-hmm. okay, great. You know, and oftentimes there's something to be taught. If the 500K biller is on a team with 300K billers, then maybe the 300K billers would learn something if they paid attention to the activity of the 500K biller. And mm-hmm. And so there's, I think, times like that. It just doesn't really, I think we've all, once we've been in this business as long as we have, we're all used to kind of keeping an eye on something. Some, like, I know if you ask me, like, what do you keep an eye on from a metric? And I'm self-employed. I could tell you exactly what I watch daily for myself mm-hmm. to make sure that I'm going to get where I want to each week, each month, each quarter, and at the end of the year. And I know mm-hmm. that if I hit those daily metrics, I will get my goal is. Mm-hmm. And I think most of us that have been around for at least 5 years in this industry are used to keeping an eye on something. And that's, you know, if you're able to have that kind of success, keeping an eye on that, whatever that thing is, then mm-hmm. That's probably what a new firm would say, hey, let's just keep an eye on that then, because we know that mm-hmm. that's how success is driven.
Yeah. And you could boil it down to, if somebody's a senior person, they're not going to want to track calls or conversations or phone time, most likely. But you could certainly boil it down to three things. You could say first interviews, new search assignments, submissions, like literally just those three. That's all we're going to track. And with that, absolutely. I don't think you would get a lot of pushback, because if it feels heavy handed or it feels overly like it's going to slow you down in some way or you're being micromanaged, then people are right to push back on it. But I always try to advise owners, just pick three, pick the three most important and make that the focus of what you're going to track and what you're going to manage around. And I think there's something about the symmetry of that or the clarity of it that doesn't get as much pushback. And it also helps people to know, this is how we're measuring success. This is how we know we're on the right track, you know?
Well, and look, you know, in this modern day and age where we should all be putting our information into some sort of an ATS CRM type system. And it, mm-hmm. if you're just logging your activity in there, which you should, it can be used in a very positive way to actually generate more revenue, mm-hmm. to keep track of candidates you put in 6 months ago, you know, go back and revisit old clients, that kind of stuff. So it's not a punishment. We have to have mm-hmm. a way to put our information into a system and use it. And if we're just logging our activity in the system, which all of us should be doing, it's all right there. The system does it for us. Even mm-hmm. the worst ATS is going to tell you how many new candidates you put in and how many interviews you scheduled. You know, yeah. it's just, so for me, it's like, I think most of us understand that there's going to be some sort of like, paperwork side of things. And then mm-hmm. there's going to be an opportunity to talk about that a little bit along the way. And I think most people are okay with that. Those that are not, either go the path of self-employment because they just don't want to play ball at all. And they feel mm-hmm. like they don't need to in order to be successful, and God bless them. I don't know how they do it, but I respect that they can. And I wish them mm-hmm. the best of luck, and they go out on their own and do it. But if you're going to go to work for somebody else, you got to have something that you kind of talk to each other about to monitor the ability to make placements and have success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, listen, this has been very fascinating for me. I'm glad I had you on, because this is a perspective that I don't get very often. It's different to hear from someone who is just recruiting recruiters and recruiting recruiters at a high level. So for those of you listening, I'm just going to recap some things that I wrote down or that I heard that I think you should keep track of. One is, you know, if you recruit people at the level that John is talking about, these are going to require a lot less handholding, which is a big thing to think about. I know there's a lot of fear with regards to hiring someone, you know, how much of my time is this going to take up? But with the high level proven track record approach, you're getting people who can hit the ground running, at least theoretically, right? So that's one thing to think about when you're thinking of training someone from scratch versus bringing in a proven producer. One of the things John mentioned is that if you're looking at a lateral move, meaning someone who's an individual contributor and you want to hire them as an individual contributor, it's going to be a tough sell right now because they're probably making a lot of money. So you may need to offer something that either provides a bit of a bump or a cushion for them for the transition, or more than likely, you're going to have to provide some type of a path for them to do something beyond what they're doing now, whether that's management or building a team or starting a division or something else. So one of the things to think about is perhaps if you're a permanent firm and you want to start a temporary side, you could hire one strategic person who has that experience and they could come in and help you to build out that side of your business. And one thing that John mentioned is that the contract aspect of your business is going to give you a lot more equity when it comes time to sell your business. So if you're wanting to sell your business, if that's a path that is part of your exit strategy, having a temp side to your business would make that a lot more worthwhile. So what else did I write down here? So for virtual, if you're able to hire people who can work virtually, it's going to open up the whole country for you, perhaps the whole world for you, versus someone who has to be regional. I think there's definitely pluses to having someone local. But the way that the market is now, if it's a very tight market, you're not finding who you need, you probably want to broaden that. Think about a digital footprint. Let's see. He talked about different types of guaranteed income in the first year that you might need to provide a first year cushion for someone. So one of the examples he mentioned was someone who comes in with a 100K salary, but on top of that has a non-recoverable draw for the first 12 months. And that draw would be, in one case, 100 to 200K additional, and perhaps path to partnership as well, right? So you're giving them some type of a path where they can go that's beyond what they're doing now, but also a cushion to make that first year more palatable for them, because they're going to go from high production to zero production when they start with you. And let's see. So he mentioned a 20% increase in salary would be, you know, 10 to 20% somewhere in there, plus perhaps this cushion that I mentioned. We also talked about finding good recruiters. What are the characteristics? And one thing that he mentioned is something that I have found as well very much is that athletes tend to be very good salespeople in general. They're used to goals. They're used to numbers. They're used to being evaluated. They're used to criticism. They're used to losing and having to recover. And so athletes, if you're looking for someone, that's one marker that you can think about. Also, this, you know, concept of doing it yourself versus having outside help. If you want to do it yourself, then you would have to dedicate a decent amount of time to doing that, just the same way you would to anything else. So if it's a part of your business, if you don't want to pay a fee, you really would have to dedicate some time to understanding your market and where you're going to find someone. And then lastly, we talked about micromanaging versus allowing people, especially high-level people that are coming in, to have a sense of freedom. John mentioned that with success comes more freedom. And we talked about just refining down to the most essential KPIs. If you don't want to have a complicated system of tracking, you could just do send-outs, submissions, and job orders. And that's where we got to for this conversation. So John, thank you so much for joining me today. It was great to hear you and have your voice here. And I'm looking forward to having you back for part two as well.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Good. All right. Well, and for those of you listening, shoot me an email to gary@therecruitinglab.com. Let me know what you think. If you've got feedback for John, you can send it our way, or you can contact him at R2RSearch. And John, what is your website?
That's it. R2. So it's R, the number two, rsearch.com.
Perfect. All right. Great. Well, thanks everyone for listening. And we will be back next month, same time, same place, with another interview. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.